Later on Friday, former Catalonia president Puigdemont was released by a local court, but the politician will have to remain in Sardinia until questions such the validity of the European arrest warrant against him and his immunity status are resolved. Should the arrest be considered valid, the same court will have to decide whether to hand him over to the Spanish authorities.
Italy's justice ministry on its side has made clear it had played no role in the case, which, quote, was the sole preserve of the judges involved, Max Civili, Rome.
Islamic and national factions in the Gaza Strip held a protest in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who are under hunger strike and are subjected to Israeli abuse. The event that included Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross headquarters came a day after an ex-prisoner, Hussein Masalma, died of cancer after being detained for 19 years.
We are here in front of the Red Cross to remind the international human rights organizations of their role to protect our prisoners inside Israeli jails and who are under solitary confinement. There are six prisoners under hunger strike protesting the inhumane Israeli abuse against them and the illegal administrative detention. This is not the only medical negligence of hundreds of our prisoners, but an international killing practiced by the Israeli regime.
Al-Masalma's medical condition deteriorated due to complications resulting from Israeli medical negligence and torture at the time he was in custody that led to his inevitable slow death.
There is no doubt that Palestinian detainees are witnessing tough measures and abuse inside the Israeli jails, especially following the escape operation. Yesterday, Al-Masalma succumbed to his cancer that deteriorated while being in jail. There are more than hundreds of inmates who have lost their lives in Israeli jails due to intentional medical negligence.
Palestinian factions say they won't sit idle while Israeli violations against the prisoners are increasing, urging the international community to take serious action to save the prisoners' life.
We are holding Friday prayer here in front of the Red Cross to express our support to our prisoners who are a symbol of our Palestinian cause. We will always be proud of their patience. Our message to the Israeli regime is clear. We hold Israel responsible for the lives of our prisoners and we won't remain silent over these violations.
Palestinian detainees are passing through hard medical conditions as 15 inmates inside Israeli jails are diagnosed with cancer, while more than 200 others have lost their lives as a result of the Israeli systematic policy of medical negligence.
While hundreds of Palestinian detainees, including women and children, are subjected to inhumane violations of their rights inside Israeli jails, Palestinians here are paying efforts demanding the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue. Roba Shabit, Gaza.
For the past 20 years now, the European Union has been pumping billions of euro into Ukraine. The master plan, according to analysts, is to create a big ally right next to Russia. The problem is Ukraine is still corrupt to the core, according to a new report from the EU's financial watchdog, the European Court of Auditors, or ECA. We spoke online to one of the authors.
The Commission should rethink the strategy, more focused on the root causes of this corruption, and we say the grand corruption.
Since 2014 alone, EU taxpayers have sent 12.5 billion euro to Kiev via the European Commission. Corruption reform efforts funded by the EU have failed, the European Court of Auditors report finds. Critics say the EU uses Ukraine as a pawn to provoke Russia. On the issue of energy alone, it appears Moscow would be of greater benefit to the EU.
When you look at this scathing report, does it make you think that perhaps you've picked the wrong side in all of this?
It is not vis-a-vis one or the other country that Ukraine is a strategic partner. Ukraine is an important country in its own rights.
The European Court of Auditors report states the EU has long been aware of the connection between oligarchs, high-level officials, politicians, the judiciary and state-owned enterprises. However, the 27-nation bloc has failed to tackle this with its cash injections. Experts say gangsters are running Ukraine.
we see that they have their people and their ideas, which is much more serious, all over the place, in the parliament, in the government.
The EU's executive arm insists progress has been made in the fight against corruption in the country, despite what the ECA report says. The European Commission's defence of Ukraine simply could not have been more robust. There's little to no doubt taxpayers will view that as scandalous. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
South Korea announced a daily record 2,434 cases of COVID-19 for the period ending Thursday at midnight, as the country struggles to rein in a fourth wave of the pandemic. The increase in cases, together with a vaccine supply shortage hampering immunization schedules, has generated public concern.
I was told that getting vaccinated, there should be 2 to 4 weeks between the first and second doses. I'm stressed out about vaccines because I have seen many people, including my family members, getting their second shot 6 to 8 weeks later.
South Korea was somewhat slow to reserve vaccine supplies, with roughly 42% of the population now fully vaccinated. Several wealthy countries, such as the U.S. and U.K., have provided vaccines to all who wanted them, and are now offering booster shots.
In South Korea, you cannot get vaccinated whenever you want because there has been a lack of vaccines, especially at first. On the other hand, in other countries like North Korea and very poor countries, they don't have any vaccines. I think it's unfair globally.
South Korea in August earmarked $2 billion to make the country a vaccine production hub, to in future secure enough vaccines domestically and assist in creating an adequate global supply. South Korean officials had eased restrictions for Chuseok, the Thanksgiving holiday, which wrapped up earlier this week, in order to provide some relief from the previous stricter social distancing measures. But authorities here again Friday tightened restrictions in order to try to bring the current fourth wave surge under control. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he has worked with all previous three American presidents, but does not seem to have a good start with the current one. Erdogan's comments came right after his arrival to Turkey from the U.S. Erdogan noted that Ankara will not step back from its deal with Russia for the purchase of S-400 surface-to-air missiles, which had already created tension between Turkey and the U.S.
We have not experienced such a situation with previous U.S. leaders. When it comes to fighting terrorist organizations, the U.S. gives them loads of equipment. My wish is to have friendly and not hostile relations with the United States, but the way things are going between two NATO allies is currently not too auspicious.
Erdogan also criticized U.S. failure in Afghanistan, adding that Washington cannot expect Turkey to pay the price of its irresponsible behavior there. He added that the U.S. cannot expect Turkey to receive Afghan refugees and open its door to them.
The problem between Turkey and the United States continues, and their relations have been strained lately due to several issues, including Afghanistan and Syria and other regional disagreements. Even before U.S. presidential elections, Biden showed a negative attitude towards Turkey and the Turkish government. As two NATO allies, those differences must be resolved. However, the U.S. is aiding militants whom Turkey sees as a threat to its national security. Endangering the security and stability of another NATO ally is supposed to be against NATO principles. I think we are going to witness more tension in the coming days.
Turkey-U.S. relations have been at loggerheads due to U.S. continuous support to YPG Kurdish militants in northern Syria. Washington is accused of providing Kurdish militants affiliated with Kurdistan Workers' Party with weapons and training. The Turkish president was hoping to solve disagreements between his government and the Biden administration in his visit to the U.S., but it seems things got more complicated than before. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
After liberating the whole province of Al Bayda from the Saudi-backed groups, Yemen's armed forces began moving toward the eastern region of Shabwa. Bayhan, Ain, and Usaylan directorates were captured during the first phase of the operation.
The Yemeni army is making these advances in Shabwa with the support of God, because there is a big difference in what we and the enemy possess in military capabilities. We are fully aware that the enemy does not want peace. They are the ones who launched the aggression against the Yemeni people, and they seek to keep our country weak. Therefore, we will continue to resist until we force the enemy to submit to the will of the Yemeni people and stop its year-long war and siege.
Military experts say the liberated areas have strategic importance as they are overlooking Ataq, the capital of Shabwa Governorate, as well as Harib area of Marib, meaning that all supply routes linking Shabwa with Marib will be cut off for the Saudi-backed forces.
These advances come as part of the process of encircling Marib because the Saudi-led coalition did not respond to our peace initiative regarding Marib, and therefore a military operation is necessary to cut the supply routes linking Shabwa with Marib, especially the areas of Baylan, Ain, or Ceylon, which the Saudi-backed forces depended on. During the next 24 hours, we witness more significant developments, especially in the Harib and Abiyana districts in Marib.
Recently, the Yemeni army has captured vast areas in the oil-rich province of Marib from the Saudi-backed forces. This has pushed Yemen's army to upscale its operations and move toward eastern areas to liberate all Yemen's soil from foreign powers.
Yemenis say the army is determined to liberate Yemen's territories from the hands of invaders. They believe that the army has the upper hand and will eventually expel all proxies of the U.S., Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates from the country. Yav Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis. Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest, and stand by its ethos, considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In the downtown area of Kashmir's capital city, Srinagar, lies the centuries of traditions and legacy that came to Kashmir via Silk Route from Central Asia. This part of the main city, Srinagar, remains untouched by modernization. Set up on the banks of River Jhelum, the downtown Srinagar is home to many scholars who came to Kashmir along with their disciples to preach Islam. Some seven centuries ago, Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani came from Iran along with scores of artisans, preachers, scent makers and traditional healers. These men settled around the banks of River Jhelum and taught their specialities to the locals. And to date, these teachings are the source of survival for tens of thousands of people in Srinagar. Let's meet probably the last scent maker of Kashmir, Azizullah Kozgar. Few steps away from the shrine of Shah-e-Hamdan, or Mir Sayyad Ali Hamadani, this is an Arkigulab Dukan, or Rosewater Shop. It is a major attraction for tourists and the younger generation. The 65-year-old Kozgar's shop is filled with centuries-old jars, some empty and a few partly filled. Kozgar is the last remaining rosewater maker. This shop carries 400 years of Kashmir's legacy.
For Muslims, rosewater has a spiritual as well as religious significance. This shop was set in 1820, and these glass bottle jars and decanters were imported from different parts of the world. We have a collection of other fragrances besides rosewater. We have been making herbal medicines, but now people prefer modern science instead of traditional methods.
The Kozgar family has been in the trade for distilling rosewater for four centuries, and the entire process is done manually. His customers, however, can't do without his handmade fragrances and herbal syrups.
We have been living here for centuries, and we know the worth of his pure rosewater and other products. Besides that, his herbal syrups and ointments have been healing our ailments, whether related to skin or immunity. We use his rose water during special occasions and during the holy month of Ramadan to make special drinks.
Kozgar's rose water is made specifically from Kashmiri roses and has been used for centuries to perfume shrines and mosques, since it is believed to be extracted in the best of its form. Azizullah Kozgar has acquired these skills from his forefathers, who had traveled here from Turkey some 500 years ago. He says they have kept the secret method rolling from one generation to another, but he fears whether his son will take it or not, and wishes that somebody comes forward and takes the legacy ahead. Kozgar says the political uncertainty, lockdowns and lack of people's interest in pure rose water have resulted in falling demand, and these reasons might sooner or later force the closure of his centuries-old business in Srinagar. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 27th, 2021. One of the most representative examples of the active socio-political presence is that of the women of the Ahlul Bayt. As one trained in the school of Islam and attached to the household of infallibility, there are real examples of the idea that Muslim thinkers have put forward in their views on the role of women, Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, is a prominent example in the history who shows the active presence of a woman in one of the most important socio-political scenes of history. Shia identity is tied to Ashura culture, so that after the event of Ashura and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his companions, every socio-political movement formed in the history of the Shia has a relation, whether direct or indirect, to Karbala and benefit from its teaching. This close relationship between the socio-political currents of the Shia and the Ashura event shows that one of the most important aspects of this uprising is political. Now the question is whether this historical and identity-making political uprising was formed by women or men. Is the movement a masculine or a feminine or a human one? Certainly, the presence of the women of the Ahlul Bayt in the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala is known and an unalterable fact in the Islamic history. But was this presence a passive act in following their men, or was it an active complementary role playing alongside men? To answer this question, we should review the Karbala event from a feminine perspective. Although the main hero of Karbala is Imam Hussein alayhi salam, history cannot narrate the Karbala event without mentioning the name of Lady Zainab alayhi salam.
Holy Defense, a Mirror of Ashura. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Wars, apart from destruction, carnage and pillage, are sources of various innovations in different fields. A significant part of art and literature has been formed in and after wars. A big number of poems, paintings, novels, and so on has been created about various wars in different parts of the world. The best literary works like Shahnameh of Ferdowsi, Odyssey of Homer, and War and Peace of Tolstoy have been written on the events of war and national events and myths. It should be said that Epic literature shapes a big share of literature of every nation and is the mirror of lofty ideals of mankind. The 8-year war that the Iraqi dictator Saddam imposed on Iran in the 1980s upon the order of his Western and Eastern masters caused the Islamic Revolution of Iran to enter a new phase and set the ground for creation of the literature and poetry of the Holy Defense. The Holy Defense of the Iranian nation had taken Imam Hussein's Ashura uprising as its role model. The very mentioning of Hussein's name would inspire the Iranian combatants, and they used to recite poems and eulogies on Imam Hussein and his companions in the battlefields. An epic usually consists of two parts. The first part is the creation of the epic in the battlefront, and the second part is to convey the message of the epic. The second part is often fulfilled by a group of writers, poets, and artists who have just changed the weapons and continued the work of the combatants in a new form. Many novels and poems have been written on the Holy Defense, but one of the most important and bestsellers of this genre is the book Da by Sayyid Azam Husseini. The book is based on the memoirs of Sayyid Zahra Husseini and is a detailed documentary report of the days of war by a teenager girl. Da means mother in Kurdish, and the writer has chosen the name to manifest the very part of the sacrifices of the Iranian mothers, especially those in the war-torn regions during the 8-year imposed war. Many experts believe that this book is the most important and impressive book in the field of memoirs of the war. This book has been published nearly 140 times and gained the title of the Book of the Year for several years. The writer says that the reason for popularity of the book is that it has been narrated by a woman, which differs from the narration of men. The efforts of artists to keep alive different aspects of the imposed war have been focused on creation of symbolic works. The pictures of martyrs on canvas or walls always show resolute figures who bravely want to struggle against oppression and aggression. All these symbols try to demonstrate the victory of right over wrong. The poetry of Holy Defense, too, is a vast field of narrating the events of war. These poems tangibly manifest the valor and sacrifices of the Iranian combatants and the savagery of ungodly forces of Saddam. The poetry of Holy Defense is the epic poetry mixed with religious poetry. It has its roots in the uprising of Imam Hussein in Karbala. This kind of poetry is inspired by the merits of Imam Hussein and his loyal companions. The poetry of Holy Defense is the mirror of a struggle against the global arrogance and Zionism. It narrates the spirit of non-compromise with the enemies of Islam and their lackeys. In view of this, the names of Hussein, Abbas, Zainab, and the companions of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, are repeated in the poems. These are the names of the role models for the Iranian nation. The poetry of Holy Defense shows a sort of nostalgia for the combatants who try to sacrifice whatever they have for Imam Hussein, peace upon him, saying, O Imam Hussein, although we were not present on the day of Ashura, we follow in your footsteps
and fight your enemies who have closed ranks against Islam after 14 centuries. We are helping your descendant Imam Khomeini as he has raised your banner of freedom and justice. Karbala is not just the name of a place for poets. The name symbolizes nobility, dignity, self-sacrifice, steadfastness, fidelity, and all good virtues of Imam Hussein's encampment. Karbala is the lofty manifestation of all human characteristics on one side and all animalistic and mean features on the other. Thus, the memory of Ashura and Karbala is a culture flowing throughout history. It is the yardstick for differentiating right from wrong.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the United Kingdom has been having a tough few years, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. From the time that the Brexit vote was announced until today, London seems to be running like a train which has fallen off its tracks. Now, the waning empire now is having trouble supplying petrol to the people, as long lines have become the norm at many filling stations, and there are not enough truck drivers to supply them. And overall, energy costs are up by over 250%, and this is even before going into the colder months. Is the sun setting on the British Empire? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this Spotlight.
Britain is witnessing long queues outside fuel stations, including the capital, London, following fuel rationing at some distribution centers and temporary closure of many retail stations. British Petroleum said it has closed more than 1,000 of its fuel distribution stations, citing a lack of both unleaded and diesel grades. The multinational gas and oil company blamed the closure on a shortage of truck drivers. The government has cautioned against panic buying, saying there is no shortage at refineries. Britons have, however, paid little heed to the pledge, as long queues of motorists have been forming outside filling stations since Saturday morning. Retailers have warned that the clock is ticking for the government and that it only had just days to prevent a significant disruption in festive preparations in the run-up to Christmas, which is only 3 months away. The administration of Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that it is looking at temporary measures to address the issue. British media say the government is mulling allowing some 5,000 truckers into Britain on short-term work visas in a bid to alleviate the acute labor shortage. The UK's Road Haulage Association, however, says Britain needs 100,000 drivers to meet the demand. The UK opposition leader has blasted the government for what he called letting the people down amid the fuel crisis.
We're obviously at a crucial time for the country, and this government is letting people down so badly, whether it's hammering working people on tax and universal credit, whether it's shortages of food and fuel. I've just been up the road, three petrol stations, one of them with a massive queue and two of them with no fuel.
The driver shortage is partly blamed on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which has resulted in tens of thousands of truckers from EU member states leaving the UK. but it has been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. The shortage has also set Britain on path for food chaos, since it has led to disruption in deliveries to supermarkets and fast food chains. The fuel issue comes as Britain is also facing a record high surge in natural gas prices, with wholesale prices being up to 250% since January. Experts say households will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms are at risk of collapsing. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce.
I'd like to welcome my guest to this spotlight, author and professor of international economics, Keith Pilby, out of London. And investigative journalist Tony Gosling, out of Bristol. Welcome both of you to the program. Well, let's start this off with Keith. Why does it seem that the country just has been in disarray for years now, but especially the last two or three?
Well, I think there's a number of things in play. First of all, there's an incompetent government, all right? There's no doubt that this is probably the most incompetent government that the country's ever had. They're there just because of their Brexit credentials, not because of any skills or competence in the jobs that they're doing. So that's a major problem. Secondly, of course, you've had COVID, which is contributing to the problems. I mean, it means that there's not enough drivers. The drivers haven't been getting their licenses and so forth. So there's no doubt that's part to blame. And then thirdly, of course, is Brexit is coming home to roost. I mean, people will want, we need the imported foreign labour into the UK. We always have, and we always will, by the way, with the ageing population. And so, people have now left. They don't want to come back to Britain. The job's easier elsewhere. You can't be sure when you come in with your lorry into Britain that you can drive it, you know, to Europe with the full load because of various bits of paperwork and bureaucracy. So people are avoiding us like the plague, in a way. And so it's a cocktail of things. And they've all come together. Some of these problems are temporary, of course. Some of them are genuinely temporary. I mean, if everyone tries to fill up their car with petrol at the same time, there's never going to be enough petrol. All right. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of underlying issues going on in the British economy. And I think it's all coming home to roost. And you put the three together, and it's a very dangerous cocktail.
Well, Tony, your perspective, I mean, Keith talked about the incompetence of the political leadership right now. Would you say that that's the major problem? Or as he pointed out, dealing with Brexit or the pandemic, how do you evaluate the main problems and this lack, it seems, of organization and consistency that we're seeing?
Well, look, first of all, to say I'm not actually in Bristol today. By a marvellous stroke of serendipity, I happen to be in Peterborough, which is at the heart of the UK's national distribution network. And I've been driving around today past some of the biggest distribution hubs in the country. IKEA, which is a big furniture right around Europe, but it's very big in Britain. Their base, Amazon's base. And I see lorries streaming in and out of these non-essential places, including big furniture distribution hubs. There's no shortage of lorries around here. I've been sitting in traffic jams with 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lorries right behind each other. And this is where the lorries go out around the country. You know, the Americans call them trucks. We still in Britain, most of us anyway, call them lorries. Now, this story, I think, has been fascinating to watch unfold, the one particularly about the fuel shortages. Of course, they were very good, the BBC, on Thursday evening when these stories first broke. I was listening to the bulletins to say there is no real fuel shortage. It's just a shortage of drivers, and one or two fuel stations might not have enough fuel. But, of course, that is guaranteed to do one thing, and that is to start panic buying the next day. And the other thing I saw was the increase overnight in the fuel prices at the petrol stations. So increases of between 5 and 10 pence a litre just that evening after the story broke. So this to me says one thing, and the reason I'll underline this is because I know for a fact, having seen particularly lots of these vehicles going around, lorries going around and trucks in around Northamptonshire, is that the fuel companies are the most profitable in the world. If anyone can guarantee high pay and a guaranteed pay for their lorry drivers, truck drivers, then it's the BPs, the SOs of this world. They have no shortage of cash. Their profit margins are the highest in the whole of the Western world, as many shareholders who invested them will attest. And so the idea that they cannot afford to keep fully staffed their distribution networks, to me, is utter nonsense. And I was really appalled to see that the BBC, when they're reporting this story, don't comment on the fact that the oil corporations in the West anyway operate as a cartel. The idea that one is any separate to the other, they all work in concert. And of course, they are globalist, global corporations. They're all anti-Brexit. They're all Remainers, or as we still call people who still want to be part of the EU, Remainiacs, who still want to plough this furrow. So I'm absolutely convinced that this is a collusion, really, between the big oil companies and the big media, all based in London, to really just bamboozle the public into panic buying, effectively. So it's a very irresponsible type of journalism. And as we know, there is no real fuel shortage, but it creates a sense of panic to see people queuing up. And I think it's an absolutely appalling misuse of the broadcasting networks and the newspapers to try and panic people in this way. If there was a problem at a few fuel stations, then people would hardly notice. But the idea that you're saying, oh, you know, you're going to have to fill your cars up tomorrow, and then making an extra load of money by putting the fuel up overnight, to me, it's a cynical abuse and misuse. And actually, of course, this is really about pay. It's not about a driver shortage. It's about people not being paid enough. And if these various distribution companies started to give decent wages to these lorry drivers, which is, that's exactly what people should be doing. If you've got a shortage, you start to pay your people more. It's a very antisocial job. You're spending many nights away from home. You have to sit in traffic jams, wait for roadworks to be finished for hours sometimes, crawling forwards. It's a horrible job to have to do. And so these people need to be paid properly, and then okay. In which case the distribution networks will be back up and running tomorrow.
What do you think about that, Keith? That was interesting what Tony said, the globalists versus the Brexit individuals. Your take on this? I mean, how much of this is created, and how much of this is real?
Well, a lot of it is real, I'm afraid. I mean, you may be in Peterborough watching it all distributed. That's true. There's going to be a lot of trucks there by the very nature. But the point is that there's not just fuel shortages. There's shortages on the shelves. People are queuing to get an appointment with their GP. I mean, the idea that there's not just these problems are just nothing to do with Brexit and the labour shortage in Britain is, unbelievable. We may be Remainiacs. Many of us will turn into rejoiners, I think. And the point is that it's widespread throughout the economy. It's not doing well. Global Britain is failing to do trade deals with America, as promised. The Australians, it doesn't really matter. We do so little trade with them anyway. That's the reality. And so to deny that Brexit doesn't play a role in this is unbelievable. And of course, if you've got queues of people, you're going to raise your price. That's called capitalism. And the person that makes the most money out of fuel in Britain is, in fact, the government. So when you fill up with your litre of petrol, something like 75% actually goes to the government. 75%. So the idea that they're profiteering companies have got all this money, the BP share price has not done well over the years. So there's a number of inaccuracies from your previous correspondent, I'm afraid. And the labour market is tough in Britain at the moment, finding the people with the skills and prepared to do these low-paid jobs. Of course, pay will go up. That's how a market economy works, and if there's a shortage of lawyers. But it doesn't happen overnight, all right? The shortage is 100,000. So you don't train 100,000 people to drive these trucks overnight and bring it in the army.
Well, let's
like
just stop right there. The shortages, let me just jump in here, Keith, because the shortage you're saying is 100,000. I mean, couldn't this have been foreseen? It's not something that it's just, say a couple of hundred. I mean, that's a lot of people. It took it to get to this point for the government to realize that there's a crisis. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, the government's been warned about it for months. But it's been going on for months. Industry has been telling them pre-Brexit we needed a good deal. We needed certain occupations. We needed seasonal workers for the farmers. Because they're all planning less crops next year, not more, less, because they haven't got the workers to pick it. So the government has been ignored, ignoring all these calls, because they're, you know, their beloved Brexit, now we're seeing the costs. And eventually people will wake up and realise what a costly, wasteful and expensive exercise Brexit has been. And of course, what's the sad thing about this? It's not the rich that are going to suffer. The rich have got plenty of money to fall back on savings. Ultimately, it's the people that were brought on board by Boris and his cronies that voted for this. And they're going to be the poor people often that, you know, former Labour voters, and they've been sucked into the Conservative Brexit fanatical game. And now they're the people who are going to most suffer from it all.
Okay. Well, Tony, what about that? I mean, it just seems that there was not a whole lot of calculation into the chain effect of decisions that were made.
Well, look, I'm old enough to remember the real fuel shortages we had in Britain back in 1973, where we had queuing outside petrol stations for months on end, where that was caused by the Yom Kippur War,
well,
the October War.
I'm sorry to jump in here. I'm not just talking about the petrol right now.
Yeah,
I'm just talking about in general.
That was a real fuel shortage. Mm-hmm. This is not. And I go back to my initial point that these fuel companies can easily afford to pay properly drivers who will work for them, but they have chosen to use this as an excuse, really, to cause panic. Whilst Boris Johnson was at least anyway away in the United States, so that's one of the reasons I think this has taken place.
So, Keith, overall, tell me, how do you see this affecting the British people? You just now, you alluded to, of course, as always, it's the poor people who suffer. But in general, how do you see it overall affecting the people? And how will it affect the electorate in general when going to the polls?
Well, it's going to take some time. I mean, if you look at the opinion polls, it's almost astonishing that Boris is still in the lead. If you look at opinion polls, I mean, but you can only keep giving people bad news for so long. And of course, there's going to be more bad news for a lot of people. The furlough scheme ends in September. That's been supportive of a lot of people. That ends. The universal benefit, £20 a week, is going to end, which is £80 a month for a lot of people. In London, there's about to impose a congestion charge, ULEZ zone, that's going to affect a lot of people with older cars. They're generally poorer people. So there's a lot of bills, higher gas and electric bills coming, you know, not just starting in October. There's going to be a further rise in April. And inflation picking up and wage growth not keeping up with inflation. So, you know, there's a lot more bad news to come, I'm afraid. And that is going to take its toll eventually.
Tony, your thoughts? You were shaking your head a bit. Do you see brighter days ahead as Keith are actually seeing the opposite? Or tell me, why were you shaking your head?
Well, I mean, I think it's quite clear to me there's a war going on, basically, and that is between the globalists and people who are, what should we call them, Brexiteers, but, you know, nationalist Brits who have seen what's been going on with the European Union and are signalling to the rest of Europe that maybe they should think about getting out of the EU too, because this club in Brussels has proven to be effectively a kind of a Fourth Reich. In other words, it's run by big corporations for their own personal private benefit, and there's no real democracy involved at all. They've got a parliament of a whole bunch of people who can't actually make any laws. All they can do is try and slow down things by the people who are appointed to the top of the European Union. I think, yes, we are going to be under assault. It's quite obvious that's what's going to happen from those globalists. And these fuel companies, and, by the way, the BBC, are very much pro those globalist influences. In fact, they get paid. The BBC still get money from some of these globalist influences. I think we've got every bit of possibility of pulling through all this. And, you know, we have a fairly stiff upper lip, we like to say, and we will deal with these problems. But what doesn't help is when you've got the mass media actually fueling the fire. And the mass media have driven this panic buying. There is no shortage of fuel in Britain. There is actually no shortage of drivers to do fuel distribution, because
but
these companies,
Keith,
have the money to pay them.
I mean, Tony, what about, because as I said, we're just not talking about the petrol prices right now. As Keith had talked about earlier, just overall energy costs and their the stocks as far as in the stores, or not being well stocked. I mean, overall, do you see that the cause of all of this is related to what? Is it just something that's created again because of the globalists, or how do you see it?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think what we're looking at now is main infrastructure in the country coming under attack from various angles. This isn't just accidental shortages. Of course, arterial distribution, for example, of food around the country is now very, very centralized. We've just had one of our major supermarkets, one of the big four in Britain, has been taken over by American hedge funds. And that old supermarket, Morrison's, they used to deal direct with farmers. In the future, all of the meat that comes to those supermarkets will be going through the main meat distributors in the country, not through direct from the farmers to the customers anymore. So there is an attempt to bring all of this national infrastructure, I would call it, like fuel, like food, all the other things too, and energy, into private hands. And in those private hands, those private companies can work together to squeeze the supply, to cause panic, and then they can make many, many more profits. And I think we should see these kinds of infrastructures brought back into national ownership so they could be run for the interests of the population rather than for the shareholders of those companies.
Keith, how do you see what Tony's assessment just now?
Well, I mean, We try to run a capitalist society, a mixed economy. We certainly don't want to nationalise everything, and private sector does many, many good things, OK? So that's nonsense. The only booming business in Britain at the moment is bureaucracy and filling in forms, the Northern Ireland Protocol. Every farmer will tell you exporting has been a nightmare. You can see it in the figures. The Brexiteers may deny it, but the figures are staggering, the fall in trade with the EU, and that similar trade has not been affected outside of the EU. So they're denying it. They caused the problem. People voted for it. They voted for a fall in their living standards. That's what people have voted for. They voted for less funds for the government, less tax. Therefore, their tax must go up if they want the similar level of government services. And that means the government becomes a bigger part of the economy. So you can't have it both ways. If you want your sort of national identity and keep the immigrants out, well, you can have
sovereignty.
That.
No, I'm not saying that. I didn't say anything about immigrants, did I? I think it's quite fair to keep going with immigration where it's necessary. And I'm not against immigration. I think there should be, you know, basic rights, of course, for people like asylum seekers. I'm not against that at all. But I think you've got to run the national economy in the national interest. And we can only do that where the private predators are not preying on their distribution networks and their monopolies to fleece the public for the benefit of their shareholders.
Okay, and I have to thank both of you for a lively discussion and being with me on this spotlight. Unfortunately, we are out of time, out of London. Keith Pilbeam, author and professor of international economics out of Bristol. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist. Appreciate it. And as always, appreciate you being with us on another